Support for National Native News and Juno Afternoon comes from Clinkin and Haida social enterprises like Sacred Grounds Coffee, Sacred Shine Auto Detailing, and Smokehouse Catering. Learn more at www.ccthita-nsn.gov. Clinkin and Haida. Local. Indigenous. Proud.
KTOO would like to take a moment to recognize that we are on Tlingit Ani, the homelands of the Tlingit people. The borough of Juneau has two clans, the Akwan and the Takwan. The place from which KTOO broadcasts today is the ancestral home of the Tlenedi, of Dog Salmon people, of the Akwan. We acknowledge those families of the Tlenedi who made use of this land and waterway for thousands of years and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and for future generations.
Hanson Gress, Ka eat with the Shu Yi, we Kashuk ayi tin. Jin kat ka ke jin ta khanakhaya ha anikakh gunshish.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon. Great to have you here with us as we look at one of the biggest educational success stories of Alaska, the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute's annual region-wide education conference, which teaches the teachers to look at culture as a powerful educational tool. And joining us, David Shakely Early, who is the Education Program Manager at the Heritage Institute, and also Dr. Lisa Richardson, who has organized this event in the past. She's a professor at the University of Alaska Southeast. So thank you both for joining us. And David, I thought we'd start off with you. I know that as you get closer towards a conference, and this is starting on Thursday, August 5th, that everybody gets into warp speed mode with lots of balls to keep in the air.
That is true. It is getting very busy in the planning processes for this conference. Things are all falling in line, though. There's a lot of pieces that are moving, like you said, and a lot of balls that are up in the air. But at the end, we anticipate and really expect and hope that everything's going to run really smooth. And this is a virtual event conference that we're putting on this year. Last year, we had to have a virtual event for the first time due to COVID. So since it is a second virtual event, we are able to play off of some of the things that we've learned last year, and we don't have to start things from scratch.
Well, this is considered very innovative as far as education goes. Lisa, it must be nice to have helped to plant some of the seeds for this.
It is. It's a really powerful event, and one that we see as a genuine collaborative conversation. You know, we create the structure and the speakers and breakout sessions, but what we love is the fact that we've built it in a way that it's so interactive that participants are able to kind of contribute to the content, that they have opportunities for discussion and engagement, and really thinking deeply about how we integrate culture, how we integrate language and effective pedagogies for all of our students.
We hear more frequently now, as the Canadian boarding school deaths are brought up, horror stories about how children were taught, not just in Canada, but in this country, here in Alaska. And it was almost as if education was seen only through one possible cultural lens. And yours didn't matter, and it didn't even matter if you could speak the language of the teachers. How far we have come.
I think there's such value in acknowledging the past, the history that we've lived through. And I think it creates a sense of urgency, right, for continuing to advocate for and build on students' strengths that historically we may not have.
So David, are these boarding school stories a form of validation to you that you're headed in the right direction with these teacher conferences?
Absolutely, it does. And I have not personal experience of those, but my family has, you know. So my grandmother and all of her generation was a generation of these boarding schools. And for those of you out there listening, I guess, that may not be familiar, new to Alaska or somewhere else in the country, the boarding schools that we're talking of here isn't kind of like the Harry Potter boarding schools and that vision of a boarding school, learning new things and going on adventures and things like this. These boarding schools are places where Native students weren't allowed to speak their native languages. They weren't allowed to have any culture. They had to dismiss it. They had to disown it in order to be a successful person, to be a successful student, and to learn English. And English was the way to do it, and nothing else mattered. If an individual coming in, a student, were to come in and speak their language, like many, many stories that I've heard my grandmother and other of her generation and things like this, they'd get punished. They'd get soap put in their mouth, and they'd get locked in the closet, and they'd get hit with rulers, and they'd have their hair pulled, and they'd do really nasty things to force them to not speak their language, their native languages, and not practice their cultures and things like this. So I hear these stories. So it is very personal.
And I know that it's really important for people of Tlingit heritage to begin every conversation, especially when they're talking with people they don't know, with an introduction in their language and a land acknowledgement. So before we go forward, would you like to do that for us, David?
Sure. It's kind of a newer thing that has happened for sure with both land acknowledgements and introductions. An introduction, if you hear this from other people doing introductions, it's really you're introducing your family is really what it comes down to. You're introducing where you came from. So it's not necessarily I have the spotlight, I have the mic, and I'm talking about myself. You're really honoring where your past came from, because without your past, without your grandparents, without your great-great-grandparents and so on, you wouldn't be here. And so it's kind of giving that homage to them for those that are a little newer to hearing these sorts of things. And Tlingit, Tlingit k'enach, yeh yedi, yuchatu asauk, yeh nachatsati, t'akhtain tan, ayachat, hunadach, hunakawudach, shangu kedi yedi, t'akhtain tan, hatlishkuhas. So basically in saying that, I'm acknowledging my father's people, the Shungu Kedi, the Thunderbird, and my grandparents and my great-great-grandparents, and also where they come from, which is Huna. It kind of brings that forward to that as well. So anyway, that's part of a general introduction, I guess, that one might hear.
So Lisa, are these some of the things that you teach your teachers at the conference?
A lot of the work that we do in kind of designing our featured speakers and how we invite those speakers to come join us in this conversation is really grounded in exactly that, right? For example, Tiffany Lee, who is joining us from the University of New Mexico, so much of her work has been advocating for the rights of linguistic and cultural sovereignty related to place. And, you know, she's Diné, she's from Navajo Nation, but so applicable to the work that we're continuing to do. And I think it will really resonate. And you'll see the threads throughout the breakout sessions, right? These teachers that have experimented with ideas are really taken up some of these concepts and they're willing to share with others. And I think that that will be a really powerful way of not only creating space for educators to share effective practices with one another, but also to continue to build and refine their understandings.
You know, it's funny when you look at some school districts, especially some in some of the more remote parts of the state, where there is a real struggle to keep a constant stream of teachers. They tend to come and go year after year, and they never really understand the culture of the students. And their first strategy is to try to teach them like they've taught children in Milwaukee or Oklahoma.
There is a lot of work being done both in teacher preparation and in graduate coursework to really support pre-service and current teachers to use the community resources, to see them as resources, to seek out an understanding of place and all of the amazing brilliance that is present in the land and the elders and the community members and their students themselves. It's an ongoing conversation for sure. Like so many things that are so complex, there's no quick fix, but I would say it's a pretty strong area of focus across the state in all communities. And we also see that the more confident that the new teachers to Alaska become in engaging with their communities, the bigger gains we see in retention, right? If you feel a lack of confidence, you're going to bail pretty quickly. If you start understanding deeply the place that you're serving, then you're more likely to stick around. And we operate from that premise. And that's a big part of this conference as well, is really thinking about what tools will build confidence in teachers.
So David, how reluctant are teachers to try teaching from another culture?
Well, I've worked with a number of teachers in the past through this program that I'm with, and also just as a teacher in the district and other things, hearing from them that if a teacher just doesn't feel comfortable with teaching the culture or incorporating the culture into their lessons, into the units, into their day, for fear of maybe if I do it wrong, I might offend somebody. Maybe if I'm missing something, I'll offend somebody. Then they just say, gosh, I don't even want to gamble. I don't want to roll the dice and even gamble, because I prefer not to be looked at in a bad way or offend somebody if I try, and I just won't do it at all. And so if in that mentality, then it just doesn't get incorporated into the schools, into the classes, into the lessons. And by doing that, then it really takes something away from the student. It takes away the ability in some cases for that student to connect with the material, to connect with the teacher, to connect with the school, to connect with just going to school and being a part of school, because there's no connection that they can hang on to. It's by nature, we feel comfortable as a human being around things that we're comfortable with and familiar with. So just an example, like you go to some place that you like a restaurant even. You go there often because you like the atmosphere, you like the food, you go on vacation, you go, oh, you know what, we went to this place last time, let's go there again. Let's invite these people because we had so much good time with them. And it's something you're familiar with and you like that. If you don't have any of those connections as an individual, you shy away and you don't find that door to open up and to say, gosh, I can relate to this. I can relate to this person. I can relate to this content, and I want to be a part of it. And so it really helps, like Lisa was saying, giving teachers the confidence, allowing them to say, you know what, it's okay if you're not an expert in this material, in this culture, but even a little bit helps. A little bit helps, because then that opens a door to being more comfortable, to being more receptive to the students and their needs.
So Lisa, David has talked a lot about the reluctance of teachers to engage for fear of making mistakes or offending people. So how are you, through this workshop and through your presenters, kind of breaking that barrier?
So we have a lot of classroom practitioners sharing what has worked in their own classrooms and being willing to do so. We know that teaching is pretty isolating, so this conference really kind of creates that space for teachers to open their doors and say, here's what I tried with my students. Here's what worked. Here's how it built on students' identities. And to David's earlier point related to kind of this lack of certainty about how to approach incorporating culture and language in the classroom, we specifically designed this year's conference to have this whole series of sessions related to engaging elders in conversation and bringing their wisdom into classroom spaces. And we hope that it's twofold, right? That there's this opportunity to have a model of how that could be, and also to have resources to seek out. So every breakout session that you attend, you have that person, right? You can contact them in the future. You can say, I want to try out something similar, and you can reach out. And I think that's what I mean when I continue to kind of refer to this as a conversation, because it is ongoing.
So who are some of the key people in this year's conversation?
As far as featured speakers, we have Tiffany Lee, who I made a reference to earlier, who's from University of New Mexico, and she'll be talking extensively about her work with Indigenous youth in the Southwest region. Candace Gala, who's from the University of British Columbia. She is a Native Hawaiian and has spoken nationally around issues of language revitalization and incorporating culture. We have Nikki Sanchez, who's a Canadian activist and scholar, who will be speaking about decolonization. And she's very energizing and exciting to see. And we have a local educator from Anchorage, Ethan Pettigrew, who is a longtime Alaskan educator and has been building spaces and places that welcome students that are culturally responsive. And he has some amazing resources and examples of how to incorporate these practices into your own context. And we know we've got this wealth of amazing organizations and resources across Southeast. And that's the other thing the conference affords, right? Is this opportunity to hear across programs and to really start building some of those connections with common initiatives and common outcomes.
So how do both of you feel about this change to virtual conferences? Perhaps maybe next year it won't be the same way. You'll go back to your traditional, have everybody in a great big room and enjoy each other's company. But how is this working out?
Well, I can say that the virtual conference that we had last year more than doubled the past participants that we had in person. And there's lots of reasons for that. I mean, we have a space limitation with people coming in person and then having to travel across the state and even across the country to get in here and all these sorts of things like this. But so last year, we reached far more than we could have in person by doing this work in a virtual setting. Moving forward and thinking about future conferences, like you mentioned, maybe next year we'll be in person. We thought about already that we can't lose this virtual grasp or this virtual reach and figure out a way to tie it into an in-person conference so that we can still have this personal relationship and faces and people being in the same place, but also for those that just physically can't come here for whatever reason, we could still connect with them or find ways that they can connect to the conference and broadcast it out somehow and really have the best of both worlds, which is kind of like putting on two conferences, I guess, at the same time with some of the logistic work that go around it. But really, it's the outreach and the work that we're hoping to get out to as many people that we can. I mean, we don't want to say, gosh, we can only have so many people come in. And then after that, you can't learn this stuff. You can't engage with this. And the more outreach and the more connections we can make around the country and even in other countries. We have folks tuning in from other countries last year virtually. And even this year, we have folks from other countries tuning in and registered already now for this virtual conference.
Lisa, how does it help to have other Indigenous cultures from faraway places involved in this, even though this is a fairly local conference traditionally?
It is. And yet we know that both nationally and internationally, Indigenous populations are wrestling with many of the same ideas, many of the same challenges, and approaching it as a collective is a really empowering and powerful way to kind of go at this work. And being able to learn from all different regions what's worked, what hasn't been as effective, that is an affordance of this, not only this conference, but these conversations and the dialogue among educators and with the different featured speakers from different regions. We feel like we're really offering a space for collective problem solving, right? And collective action plans.
Collective problem solving, a safe space to do it, and maybe one that's inspiring.
The response we had last year from participants writ large was, I am on fire to do something different, right? And I have some tools I can access. And we want that, right? We want those actionable movements to keep gaining momentum. And like David was saying, I think that's what's a really strong benefit of the online platform, is that we have a wider reach and there's access and there's equity embedded within that.
So for people who want to sign up, teachers out there, what's the drop-dead deadline for getting involved in this?
We're keeping it as open as we can. We're being very flexible, and we know that there's a lot of people that have flexible schedules that move around and things that pop up. Last year was our first virtual conference. We had people registering that morning still to get into the conference. We don't want to have a gate where we close it off and say, okay, if you don't come in by next week, you're done or whatever. That's another benefit of having a virtual conference.
So what are the key dates for this conference, David?
So this conference is, again, held virtually. It's going to be a Zoom link, and it is August 5th, 6th, and 7th. And that's the 3 days this year.
And I will be sure to put links to your conference. So if people are interested in finding out more, I'll make sure that those are on the KTOO webpage for Juno Afternoon. So just in wrapping things up, are there things you want to share with our listeners?
Well, one thing I'll mention, Lisa named off our featured speakers that we have. We have four of them. In addition to that, we have about 25 different breakout sessions during this conference with a wide range of topics. So there's lots of opportunities to get in and learn more from experts in the field and fellow colleagues and things like this that have done this in practice and said, gosh, this works. Or if you haven't tried this, try it. Or, you know, maybe you've never heard of this and try it and learn about it. So there's a huge range of things that would have an interest for a lot of people here.
One important question to ask you, though, is what's the cost for this for teachers? Do they have to dig into their own pockets?
They can dig into their own pockets, but if it's like me, if I dig into my own pocket, I'm going to find nothing in there. And so that's what we're charging this year. There's no cost for the fee. In other words, we absorb the costs of this conference so that it is available and free to those who want to come and participate. We welcome everybody. I mean, it's aimed at educators. It's aimed at administration and schools and things like this. But really, if you just have education within the physical walls of a school building, end it there, then you're missing something. And this is a bigger problem than just within the school. I mean, it's a whole community that needs to be involved. We can't end when the school bell rings at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It has to bleed into everywhere. It has to bleed into the libraries and into the facilities, the organizations, everywhere. So it is open to everybody, but we have a focus on education.
So in other words, you're breaking down the silos, not just between educators, but between educators and the community.
Yes, you have to look at the whole picture and you have to have everybody involved. If you don't have everybody involved, then you're missing pieces. And it just makes everything stronger, the foundation stronger, the connections. And overall, what we're trying to do is help the student and we're helping the student. So that's what it comes down to. I mean, we're working with educators, we're working with teachers, but the result is with the student that we want to help. You know, when they come in, they need to make that connection to be confident, to be successful in schools and in education. So that's really the goal.
One of the things that I thought was very special years ago is I had a chance to watch Selena Everson work with elementary age children. Of course, she was an elder and has since passed on, but the engagement with the children was almost magical. And I almost felt in that moment that, wow, wouldn't it be wonderful if every child could have access to an elder? And so I have to ask, because you are bringing elders into this conference, are you doing something that mainstream education should take a look at, bringing elders into the education equation?
Well, I say absolutely. Lisa mentioned earlier, we're meeting with elders and having sessions with elders specifically and bringing their words in. The theme of the conference is calling on our grandparents' knowledge for future generations, native ways of knowing, learning, and being. And so calling on our grandparents' knowledge is really what we're doing and what is fueling a lot of this is tapping into their knowledge, their wisdom. Like you said with Selena, there's those connections that you can't reproduce those certain things. It kind of like with the introduction earlier, it's not about yourself. It's about where you came from and who brought you here. And who brought us here is our elders. And that's really who is bringing us forward and helping us to continue this and their wisdom, their thoughts, and their voices.
Lisa, what do you think about that? Do you think that mainstream education could take a page from this conference and its work with elders?
I think we're hoping to do just that, right? One of the core tenets of culturally responsive education is bridging home and community and schools. You don't operate in exclusion of one another. And the more that we can build that robust wraparound that really lets students' identities be at the foreground and really takes into consideration students' heritage, students' language use, and students' ancestry is just can be so empowering for the youth that we work with.
Have you seen progress from these conferences? Have you seen tangible evidence that you're headed in the right direction?
I would say yes. I would say there's a lot less resistance and fear. I would say that there are educators willing to build these connections across community resources and really create space for students to share their identities in their classrooms, to bring their cultures in. It's slow and it's steady, and we'll keep going with it.
All right. Well, I want to thank both of you for joining us today, David Shakely Early, as well as Dr. Lisa Richardson, who is a professor at the University of Alaska Southeast. Good luck with your conference, and thanks for visiting with us today.
Thank you.
Ganashish, ganashish.
Ganashish. Up next, the mysterious role of spores from fungus in the upper atmosphere, how these tiny particles help ice to form.